You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 18th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone? So who saw...
Good.
I did not wait for the response at all.
How is everyone? Hey, move on to what I want to talk about.
So, who saw the lunar eclipse?
I don't want to talk about it.
What do you mean by lunar, Steve?
I saw everyone's pictures of it.
The blood moon.
The blood moon.
How was it, Evan?
It was great. It looked awesome. Whatever. Now, the clouds came in soon after it actually went into full eclipse. So, I only got a couple minutes of being able to see it in its totality. But it was great. The thing I love about lunar eclipses, is that it has this fake look to it. It's almost like it's a prop up in the sky.
It's a special effect.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's something wrong. It's not. It looks artificial in some way. And the other, another thing I like about it is that you can see the stars right up very close to the moon in the background. Where usually on a full moon, you get all washed out. You can't see any stars, practically anywhere near the moon. Mm-hmm. But here, you could see every last little star that was poking out and around the moon. It was very, very cool.
You know, Evan, I'm real happy you enjoyed it because for me, what happened. Is what always happens. I go outside.
Oh, no. Here we go.
I'm excited. Clouds everywhere. Can't see anything because something interesting was happening in the sky, and therefore I can't see it.
I don't know why you have such a string of bad luck, Bob.
The string is years,
years, Bob. It's been decades.
Right. It's been nuts.
Would you call it a cosmic string?
It started with the worst viewing of Halley's Comet in 2,000 years.
Yeah, that was a cosmic slap in the face. Yeah, it was. That was, wow. Thanks for reminding me, Steve. That was a major disappointment.
Yeah.
That was pathetic. Not only was it crazy far away. Ugh.
We were old enough that we knew we weren't going to make the next one. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. 70, that ship is sailed. We're going to be way dead.
What about Hail Bop? We all saw Hail Bop because that was in the sky for several days.
Yeah. I remember that.
A few comets, but nothing. It's always nice, but you need binoculars, or whatever.
Yeah, the naked eye ones are always great, but I want naked eye daytime. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Make it a comet, or even better, a supernova.
Your problem is that your standards are too high. Mm-hmm. It's not that the cosmos is conspiring against you. It's that you're just too picky.
Too picky.
He's so picky that he is smited.
Yeah, I just wanted to see a lunar eclipse. That's all. I'm not asking for too much. But I could dream. I could dream about a daytime supernova. Absolutely.
Wait, when's the next solar? The one that's going to be over
2024.
Texas and Buffalo.
Yes.
And
2024.
I don't think you guys are going to want me to go, but I think we're going to go anyway. But I think we should go to Texas.
We're going to Texas.
Come to Texas. Come hang out, meet my family, and we'll go to all my favorite restaurants, and we'll...
Oh, boy.
Oh, it'd be so fun.
I'm so there.
Yay!
Guys, seriously, man. It's a couple years now. We got to, start talking about this.
Yeah, I'm in. Let's just make it.
Yep.
Steve, we were talking about having an SGU event, a viewing event.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that would be fun.
We could do a podcast, make it like a two-day thing or something.
And I think, 2 years, I think we'll be hopefully between variants at that point.
Right. We'll be on to the next pandemic, a completely different virus.
Oh, jeez.
In 2 years. Don't worry about it.
Eesh.
Yeah, did you guys see the door on Mars?
Oh, yeah.
The mouse door?
The pareidolia on Mars.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, they took images and like so many other things misidentified on Mars, this particular picture looks like sort of a doorway etched into the side of a rock.
It's got to be.
I mean, it does look, to be fair, it really does look like a doorway.
Door-ish, yeah. Door-ish, door-like.
But
sure.
How are the Martians going to get into their underground bunker,
Right?
They need a door cut into the side of the stone hill or whatever that is.
I mean, yeah, it's rectangular in shape, We're not basing it on...
Yeah, the thing is, there's no... one of the pearls in medicine is that there are no straight lines in nature. It's like when you're reading an x-ray, there's nothing natural in the body should be a perfectly straight line. So if you're seeing that, you're seeing something artificial.
Yeah, an artifact.
So it's sort of the same thing, but it's not... exactly true because there are like cleavage planes and things sure. that could be relatively straight. Here, it's not straight. These things are not straight. You look closely, like they're a little curved, or there's a jag or a doodad that looks like stone. Looks like a natural stone formation, you know?
If you look if you look at the doorway as a gestalt in the geography of that area, it makes perfect sense of what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to kind of zoom out.
Right. It's not anomalous. It's not like, what the hell? You know, it's just like, yep. This makes sense right there.
Yeah, and there's some great pictures online where it's like it shows it in that really perfectly cropped shot, and then they zoom out, and you're like, oh, it's just like a weird hole in the rock.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
And of course, everything is human size, right? That's a 6.5-foot doorway.
Of course.
Right. Yes, because I'm a human, and that's what it would be for me. No, actually, it's quite smaller than that.
Less than 3 feet. Less than 3 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. Hobbits?
Cute. I didn't realize Martians were so small. But it's always just pareidolia, just people poring over all the NASA photos and looking for anomalies, basically.
And sometimes it's blob squatch effect as well. Like, look at that thing. It kind of looks like this until you get close up. I'm like, oh, not at all.
Yeah, like the Bigfoot on Mars, which was like sideways and teeny, you know, but you rotate it and don't tell people what the scale is. And it's reminiscent of the silhouette of Bigfoot. It would be amazing if there was nothing like that on Mars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that would be
remarkable.
That would be remarkable. All right. So, guys, our next event coming up, I want to talk about this, is Arizona. Mm-hmm. We are going to be in Phoenix on July 14th. That's a Thursday. July 14th, we're going to be doing a private show plus. This is a new thing that we're doing. It's basically an expanded and extended private show. We record a podcast like we've been doing for a long time. These are always super fun. We get a little bit off the rails and have bits that are only for the live audience. But we're going to expand it by at least an hour. Right? There's going to be a 3 hours of content where we're doing songs and games and interactive stuff. But also we'll spend as much time as we can there to interact with everybody, sign books, take pictures, you know, just chat and hang out. We won't be rushed, right? We basically, you know, we'll like rent the room for the evening or the half day or whatever. So that'll be Thursday night. Then Friday evening in Phoenix, we have an extravaganza. Then we go to Tucson for a private show in the afternoon, extravaganza in the evening. So listen, if you're thinking of going, we are asking you to get your tickets now because we need to plan this event. We really need to know the ticket count is going to be for all of these events. So these are always, you know, super fun. We really enjoy going, but, you know, we strongly encourage you to get your tickets now. We really, really appreciate that. Jay, tell them how to do that.
Hello? Kara. Steve, they can go to theskepticsguide.org/events. And you will see all four shows right there listed in front of you, and the information is there as well.
Right. And don't forget, for the extravaganzas, there are also VIP tickets where you get preferred seating, and you also get to hang out with us. If you, again, want that picture or sign a book or ask us questions or whatever, there's time built in for that as well. But these are completely distinct from the private show events, which are, you know, much more elaborate.
You also get swag.
You also get VIP swag. Special VIP swag. Yeah. That is true. Uh-huh. All right, guys, let's go on with our news items. So, guys, let me ask you a question. This is like a thought experiment. Imagine if there was something about how we run our society where if we altered that thing, it would save 50. This is the United States alone, although these numbers would be similar, but proportional to other like developed nations. But in the U.S. alone, it would save 50,000 lives every year.
Oh.
And would save society $600 billion every year. Mm-hmm. Think about that. We could save 50,000 lives and $600 billion every year. Those $600 billion are in direct healthcare costs and lost productivity, which is basically how all medical issues are measured in terms of their societal costs. What's the direct healthcare costs and then lost productivity from being out from work, dying early, whatever it is. So how much do you think it would be worth investing every year to prevent that from happening? I mean, think about that.
Well, you know, what would you say? At least half of what would be saved?
I mean, you would, yeah, at least half. So the $600 billion is what's lost to society. How much of that would be lost to the government? Well, the government pays for a lot of healthcare costs. Was it like 30-40% or something? Mm-hmm. And you know, they would also be losing all the taxes from all the lost productivity. So I don't know exactly how that much would translate into, but probably a $200-300 billion a year of like revenue lost to the government, but then the economy would lose $600 billion. So that's per year. So you think, you know, usually we budget things over 10 years. Like we had the recent infrastructure bill. What is that? $1.2 trillion over 10 years. So if you think, you know, half of that would be basically $3 trillion a decade, $3 trillion. That's three times the recent infrastructure, you know, package that was passed. And that would only be investing half in order to save this amount. Not to mention the 50,000 lives a year, you know? It's like even if you're looking at it just as a zero-sum money economics game, it still would be worthwhile investment. But, you know, also saving 50,000 premature deaths every single year.
Seems like a no-brainer.
Seems like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. So you guys probably, what are we giving up? What are we giving up?
You guys,
what's the exchange?
Oh, here's the thing. We're giving up nothing because...
No, that's great. Free.
So let me tell you, so this people listening at home, I know you guys know what I'm talking about, but people listening at home, if you haven't guessed, I'm talking about burning fossil fuel, right? This is a recent analysis where they just looked at the healthcare effects of burning fossil fuel.
Oh boy.
Let's what took so long?
Forget about it. Well, this is not the first one. This has been done previously. And the they looked in particular at the particulate matter that gets released when you burn, especially coal and gas and gasoline, you know, oil. Natural gas is much better, much, much better. It, you know, in terms of the particulate matter, it releases a small amount of particulate matter, but not nearly as much. That's why you can, you know, burn it in your home, right? On your stove.
Yeah, but it's still not great.
It's still not great. Yeah. But mainly for other reasons. But in terms of the healthcare costs, I mean, you know, as I say, like coal is worse than oil, is worse than natural gas.
Yeah.
But we still, you know, moving away from coal is like the no brainer. That's the huge 90% thing we have to do as soon as possible. And to the point, like, you know, if you could get rid of all coal today and replace it with natural gas, would you? You'd have to say yes. I mean, you'd want to go to nuclear and renewables, but if you could go to natural gas, it would, or fusion or whatever, or matter, antimatter, whatever is available. But it would still be, you can't deny that it would be a massive improvement. From the health perspective and from other, you know, other perspectives as well. But obviously the goal is to ultimately get completely away from fossil fuels. So yeah, this analysis, you know, looking at the healthcare costs, that's what they find. This is in line with you know, similar analyses. I also looked up, because I know this, we have talked about this before, I think there was, you know, many studies just looking at what about the climate change effects of, you know, burning fossil fuel. And the most recent analysis I could found that the United States would, again, just looking at the U.S., would gain $3 trillion. The economy would grow by $3 trillion and add 1 million jobs over the next 50 years if we rapidly decarbonize our industry. And this would also save an estimated $14.5 trillion in mitigation costs, just mitigation costs over the next 50 years. So that's another $290 billion a year. So we're getting close to $1 trillion a year, $900 billion or so a year for the cost of burning fossil fuel. And you could think of this as like, this is the externalized cost that we are allowing the fossil fuel industry not to pay for, you know, to just put that
cost. Giving them a free ride.
$900 billion a year that we're just going to put on the rest of society, and we're going to kill 50,000 people a year.
Pretty much the amount of people that the United States loses every year on the roads from cars.
Yeah, more. Like the average is like 30-something thousand.
True,
so a little bit more. Yeah, same order of magnitude.
And, plus all the money they don't pay in taxes. Just saying.
Yeah.
they get subsidies. Why? You know, they get direct subsidies, and then they get indirect subsidies through allowing them to externalize the costs of of using their product as directed, right? This is not like people are doing it wrong. Like if you do use gasoline as it's meant to be used, this is an unavoidable consequence. And the
right.
And it's not like people have that much of a choice. You know, we're starting to get choices, and it's mainly for people who are wealthy enough. You know, they have enough resources, they have the privilege to have the choice. But for many people, they don't really have a choice. Like, this is the infrastructure of our society. If you want to go to work or do whatever, you are going to be burning fossil fuels just to go about your day. Like, you can't really avoid it.
To be clear, that is also a direct consequence of fossil fuel industry lobbying.
Yeah,
like there's a really and if you guys haven't seen it yet, there's a three-parter on Frontline right now about big oil, like the cost of big oil, and it like goes through the history. It basically compares it to the tobacco industry. Like, what did they know and what were they saying to the public when they knew that?
It's the same people, Kara. It's literally the same individual people.
You're right.
Who were running the PR campaign for the tobacco industry, who then moved over to the fossil fuel industry.
Wait, and so you think about it. By now?
You know, there were legal cases where, you know, where the legal system, you know, the justices decided that the tobacco industry needed to pay states for their health care costs that were incurred because of people using their product because they hid what they knew to be the healthcare risks of using their product. And you could make the same case for the fossil fuel industry. You really can make the same case.
There is direct evidence in company documents, especially they focus a lot on Exxon, that several decades ago, Exxon made a big push to become an alternative energy company, and then they like backtracked. Like we could have been in such a different place.
Oh, they thought they would make more money by pulling oil out of the ground.
Yeah. Yep.
So here, but let's put this into we're just talking about healthcare costs. If you include all of the climate change stuff, it becomes much huger. Think about a couple of other layers as well. Now that, you know, because of the war in Ukraine and, you know, the gasoline is going through the roof, et cetera, there's been a lot of articles, a lot of analyses about what does energy security and independence really look like? Because even though the U.S. produces more oil, more fossil fuels than we burn, we don't set the price of oil. It's set by the world market, and we're not the big player in that. We're not the people who actually decide. It's really the Middle East, you know, the Saudis and whatnot. They can, you know, dial up and down the price of oil much better than American oil producers
because they're a larger supplier.
They're holding the cards. Yeah, because for various reasons, you know, they have the ability to turn it up and down a lot quicker, a lot more than we do. And, you know, one authoritarian guy going on a war of aggression can dramatically affect our energy prices and our economy. You know, we don't have energy we don't have energy security or independence, even though we are already producing more fossil fuel than we're burning. The only way to really get there is to not be dependent on fossil fuels, not be dependent on energy that is mostly coming from dictators and authoritarians around the world and unstable countries, you know, not undemocratic countries. So there's that. And then you can also think about, you know, the renewable economy is coming. Which side of this curve do we want to be on? Do we want to be on the, you know, on the leading edge or the back edge, right? Because if we don't manage this transition correctly, we may go from being dependent on Saudi oil producers to being dependent upon Chinese rare earth producers. You know what I mean? Like we already allowed China to corner the market in cobalt. They bought up all the mines in Africa, and, you know, we were like asleep at the switch when that happened. It's like, oh, so now we are completely dependent on another authoritarian government for the raw material for the batteries and solar panels and magnets for wind turbines. I know. So, but it's not too late. It's not too late. I mean, we really have to, this is like, really should be a wake up call. We really need to think, or not only do we need to invest trillions of dollars in over the next 30 years, accelerating the transition away from fossil fuels as fast as possible and we will make this money back many fold if we do that. It's a good investment. It's an infrastructure investment. You know, we shouldn't think about it as an expense. Not only that, but if we manage it properly, we can get to true energy independence, you know, where we are not you know, beholden to supply lines controlled by authoritarians in other countries.
If only wasn't blocking us from doing this.
Because we have the technology.
Right. Reality.
Or here's the other thing. When you talk about one other layer to this, when you talk about global warming, it's global. And so what we do, people say, oh, but what if we bite the bullet and invest money to change the economy, you know, and take the short-term hit, which I don't think you even necessarily need to do, but let's say that's the way you're thinking. And China and India don't, it'll have no effect. So why should we take the hit and not them?
And it's like,
okay, there's a sort of a point there, and everyone needs to do this, and you know our ability is limited to what we can control. But of course, it's not global warming's not black and white. Everything that you know, if we go to net zero by 2050, it will help a lot. Even if other people, it'll still be better than if we didn't do that, regardless of what other countries do. But here's the thing: when it comes to the healthcare costs, most of the benefits are local. They're not global.
Yeah.
It varies state by state. So California, actually, Kara, because of geography and population distribution and industry, whatever, there's all these variables. But the reduced healthcare costs of transitioning away from fossil fuels, 95% of those benefits would remain in California.
Wow. Right.
So if California reduced their burning of fossil fuel, they would maintain 95% of the benefits. The range goes from about 35% to 95% with an average of about 60% or so. So like even in Connecticut, you know, we would maintain about 60-70% of the benefits in Connecticut. So even on a state level, you know, it would still be cost effective because states in the U.S.
a little bit.
States spend a lot. They spend a lot of money on the healthcare of their own citizens. So actually makes sense at the state level to spend money to reduce the burning of fossil fuel in your own state because you will reap the healthcare benefits. And again, to the tune of $600 billion a year. So I'm hoping that, you know, we amplify this information, the idea that it's not act globally, act locally, think globally. It's like act locally and you'll benefit locally. You will reap the immediate benefits of your own investments. You don't have to depend on people halfway around the world doing the same thing or whatever.
But what this is going to take is politicians saying, I'm more concerned about my constituents and about the future of our country than the payola that I'm getting directly from the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah. And the only way that will happen is if voters hold them accountable. That's really the only way that works. And the only way for that to work is if voters are informed, you know, and that's why misinformation is so dangerous. You know, dis and misinformation is so destructive to our democracy because it takes away our power. It takes away the only mechanism that we have of holding our representatives accountable. And if we're living in their fantasy world based upon, their reality, then we don't have a democracy, really, that we're living in a mental dictatorship. Think about that. If you're swimming in total misinformation, you are living in a mental dictatorship, which is, what's worse than that? Your vote means nothing because you're voting based upon mis and disinformation. You don't have the information you need to make an informed vote. Functionally, you are not living in a democracy if that's the case.
Steve, if only there was a conference that was going to talk about misinformation. I mean,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
What I'm saying is Nexus, which is happening in August, NECSS.org. We are having a conference specifically about misinformation.
Surviving the misinformation apocalypse. Yeah, it's going to be all about these themes. We're going to have experts talking about misinformation, talking about specific topics, about it generally, about it politically. It's going to be real. I'm looking over the list of the people that we're asking to be speakers. We can't list names yet until we get confirmations from everybody. But it's like, ooh, I want to hear that talk. That's exciting. and of course, our headliner, David Copperfield. Bill Nye is going to be interviewing David Copperfield. That should be fun. Kara, tell us about SIDS. What is that?
Yeah, so I don't know if you guys have been following the news cycle, but if you have, you've probably seen a lot of articles hyping a new study that was published.
Oh, yeah.
And the hype is is hyped. It's up there. So the study was published in eBioMedicine, which is part of the Lancet. The publication date is June 1st. Isn't that weird? How is this published? Oh, here we go. Open Access Online was published May 6th, but it'll be in the June 1st edition. And the title is probably not one that anybody would, well, maybe those in the know would find interesting, but of course the coverage is what has gotten most people excited. So the title is Butyryl Cholinesterase, all one word, Butyryl Cholinesterase is a potential biomarker for sudden infant death syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And right there, I mean, you do start to get kind of, you start to hear, okay, SID, sudden infant death syndrome, something that I think we all kind of generally know about, we don't know much about. But the reason we don't know much about it is because there's not much to be known about it. You know, we can talk about statistics, we can talk about incidence rate, but when we really talk about why SIDS happens, why do suddenly infants die, we still don't know. You know, it's about 3,400, according to the CDC, it's about 3,400 babies each year who die unexpectedly. And they actually call that sudden unexpected infant death, SUID. That's sort of the umbrella term for sudden unexpected infant death. And then SIDS is a portion of that. That's the unexplained portion. But we also know that infants do suddenly die because of accidental suffocation in their sleeping environment and for other reasons. And we also know when we look at the incidence rates historically that there was a massive campaign in the 1980s, 1990s to reduce SIDS. And that campaign was an educational campaign about safe sleeping practices, having your baby sleep on their back. They actually called it the Back to Sleep campaign. That was in the mid-90s, was the Back to Sleep campaign. But many of these educational efforts started before that, removing blankets, pillows, soft toys, bumpers from inside the crib so that we reduce the risk of suffocation. There did seem to be a decline after that, but really what we now understand is that that decline was in babies who were dying of suffocation related, you know, accidental suffocation and strangulation. But SIDS itself, that sort of unknown, we don't know why the babies were dying, that sudden infant death syndrome that we can't explain by accidental suffocation, that number has maintained the same. It's really kind of held for quite a long time. And, you know, of course, clearly parents are desperate to understand, both parents of young infants who are afraid of this outcome and of course, parents of infants who sadly did die, but whose deaths were labeled SIDS deaths. Here's the rub, though. This article, Butyryl Cholinesterase as a potential biomarker for sudden infant death syndrome, is interesting and it's important, but it's been really, really, really overhyped. So what these researchers did is they looked at a very small sample, only 67 unexpected deaths, and they compared it to 10 gender match controls. The interesting thing that they did is they were able to look at blood that was taken soon after birth from all of these babies. So this was prior to the death. And they compared the levels of butyryl cholinesterase. I mean, they didn't look at that at random. They knew that there had been some, let's say, hypotheses circling that autonomic dysfunction. So the autonomic nervous system is the part, the branch of the nervous system that's responsible for things that we don't consciously do. So like breathe, our heart beats, we digest food, we can't control that consciously. And so there's long been a hypothesis that maybe there's something wrong with these babies' autonomic nervous system, and that's why they're suddenly dying. Like something's going on in their brain or in their body that tells them not to breathe or not to, you know, have these core bodily functions that are necessary for life. And so they were like, okay, butyryl cholinesterase is an enzyme that's within the cholinergic system, which is part of the autonomic nervous system. This could be a good candidate. And so they looked and they did find a difference. They found that the children who died of SIDS had lower levels of this marker than the children who didn't, but there were it wasn't super clean. Like they all had some amount of it. and the kids, I think,
the good way to say that is that they overlapped, right?
Yeah, so I was going to say there was some crossover effect, but that means something different.
Yeah.
Right. Overlapped is a good way to put it.
So, and that means that it could not really be used as a clinical marker. Clinically,
at least not as it's not based on the evidence that we have right now.
Right. Yeah. Because you know, whatever level you have, you could be either at risk of SIDS or not at risk of SIDS.
Mm-hmm. There's too much of that variability right in the middle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it could explain some cases of SIDS, for example, but not all. It could be a good place to continue with the research. Let's collect more data. Let's start to understand exactly what's going on. But basically, what most experts really started to say quite vocally after this article got so much press coverage and so much sort of unskeptical press coverage of, look, we finally figured out what causes SIDS. Now we're going to have a treatment for it, or now we're going to be able to screen for it, which is like way overblown. We're nowhere near that. Is that unfortunately, it's pretty well, I don't want to say understood right now, but it's pretty well accepted that SIDS is not one thing. And it's a multifactorial issue. There are probably multiple causes for this.
It's a garbage pail diagnosis.
Yeah, it's a catch-all diagnosis for all the stuff we can't really explain yet. And it's kind of like when we saw the drop in cases that wasn't really a drop in cases a couple decades ago, it's because we started to reclassify those deaths as strangulation and suffocation deaths. We now know that that percentage of SIDS deaths weren't SIDS. They were strangulation and suffocation.
And which we did prevent.
Which we did prevent, which was great. But we still can't prevent these remaining SIDS deaths because we don't know what they are. So I'm not saying that this article isn't incredibly important. I'm not saying it's not incredibly exciting, but it's not the end all. And very often the coverage around it has been written like it's the end all. Like we finally know what causes SIDS. And so we're going to be able to develop screens and treatments for it. And that's just simply not the case. To the extent that an organization called First Candle, which is an advocacy group, you know, to protect families or support families and try and understand SIDS better, wrote a statement, a press statement, that basically said, this week this study was published, and quote, while this is encouraging, the headlines that are coming out are deeply problematic. This is a potential biomarker that might be used to in the future to design a test or even a screening for babies that might be vulnerable, but it is only one piece of a very big puzzle. Researchers believe that SIDS has more than one origin. This is progress, and for that we should be optimistic, but it is not the entire answer. Which I think is a very measured reaction, because the worry here is false hope. It's excitement. It's these families who are deeply invested in trying to understand this. And
on Kara, and wait for the quack remedies to treat.
Exactly.
To treat this, right?
Because we already know that anytime we have something in healthcare that's not well understood, it just opens the door for pseudoscience. And so there, I mean, if you just Google like vaccines and SIDS, there is so much quackery online trying to pin sudden infant death syndrome on early childhood vaccinations. The good news is if you Google it on Science-Based Medicine or QuackWatch or, you know, many sites that work to debunk these kinds of claims, there's a lot of good explanations for why the arguments are inappropriate and do not kind of hold up to scrutiny. But it's just another example that we often see where the sort of pseudoscientific quack, charlatan, snake oil approach, that sort of community, preys on vulnerable parents who are grieving. And it's horrifying.
Yeah. And again, to put things into perspective, like it's a potential biomarker. So first of all, we have to confirm that it's an actual biomarker. Then we have to see if it actually means anything. It may just be a downstream effect that has nothing to do with mechanism. It may not
be
useful.
It could have been a sampling
clinically.
Issue.
It could be wrong. Yeah. Even if it's real, it could really tell us nothing. I mean, there are hundreds of potential biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. None of them have led to a test or a treatment or anything. It's because it's complicated. Mm-hmm. It's biologically complicated. And the reporting around this was beyond hype. It was grossly irresponsible.
It really was.
Like, to the point of lying. Like, you know, it's like, that's not even true. It's not that it's overstated. What you're saying is not even true. And then people then distrust scientists. Although scientists said they've cured SIDS 10 years ago, what happened? No, they never said that. Some reporter lied to you about what the science said. And that's why you were led to that false belief. So,
well, and the truth is, it's an egregious problem that happens. Like, there are multiple reasons that it gets this bad.
Yeah.
It's like, first, the article itself doesn't do as good a job of using balanced language and hedging. Second, the press release around the article is a little bit hyped. So then once you have a hyped press release, then yeah. you've got the journalists who are uncritically looking at this hyped press release, who are taking it to an even farther place. And then ultimately you end up, like you said, with coverage that says, cause of SIDS found, treatment on the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, what? You have to take so many steps back. The scientists who are talking about their research can do a better job of being measured. The press release and PIOs, the public information officers at the different universities and hospitals, can do a better job of being balanced and hedging. And of course, science journalists need to do a better job. And I mean, we all have to work together to kind of be careful around this hype, because hype can have direct consequences that are actually really, really, really dangerous for the public. It can backfire,
yeah.
and it can make it so that the public just doesn't trust us anymore.
All right, let's go to some good news. Jay, tell us about growing plants on the moon.
So during the Apollo moon missions, this was years ago, Steve, okay?
Yeah.
NASA astronauts brought back 382 kilograms or 842 pounds of lunar rock, dust, you know, basically anything that they can get their hands on. And since then, many experiments have been done to lunar regolith, determining what is it made out of and how can we use it? You know, overall, like, what is this good for, right? Because when people go to the moon, there's a lot of it lying around. Researchers at the University of Florida asked NASA for lunar regolith for years, and finally they were given 12 grams, only 12 grams, but they put them to good use. So those 12 grams of regolith came from three different Apollo missions. That was Apollo 11, 12, and 17. And they tried to grow plants in lunar regolith, and I'm very happy to tell everybody here that they were successful. They were able to grow plants. They grew a plant called Arabidopsis thaliana, which is a small flowering plant native to Eurasia and Africa. It's related to cruciferous vegetables. They chose the plant because its entire genome happens to have been sequenced. This allows biologists to analyze what's going on inside the plants, you know, on a molecular level. Mm-hmm. And this will make sense in a minute when I tell you what's going on. So going into this experiment, the researchers wanted to answer two questions. Can plants grow in lunar regolith? And if plants can be grown on the moon, how could that help people who are staying on the moon for an extended amount of time? This information is so important that the plant research will continue all the way up to and during when people are living on the moon. So they will be continuing to do this research for a very long time. Lunar regolith is so rare.
How rare is it?
And important. This material
is... How important is it?
It's important that they only used a gram of it for each plant. That's how little they were trying to use.
12 plants, that's it.
The researchers planted a seed in the regolith and they watered it with nutrient solution every day. 2 days after they planted the seeds, they sprouted, which that was a moment to celebrate because who knew what was going to happen, you know? After 6 days, they noticed that the lunar regolith plants were not as healthy as the control group of plants that were growing in volcanic ash, which is a simulation lunar soil. And they had another group that were planted in soil from Earth, but they picked soil that was from harsher climates. The lunar plants were also growing slower and had shorter roots, with a few of them having smaller leaves. There was different pigmentation in some of these. So clearly, you know, things weren't 100% right. After 20 days, the researchers harvested the plants before they flowered, and then they analyzed the proteins found inside the lunar soil plants. Now, this is when, you know, them knowing the genome of this particular plant comes into play. They found patterns of genes that were showing signs of stress. The plants were reacting to the more severe environment of the lunar soil, which, again, you know, not that hard to predict, but it was important that they could specify exactly what was going on. In fact, among the samples that came from the moon, and this is my favorite part.
Say it.
The Apollo 11 samples did not grow as well as the other two moon regolith samples from the other missions, which were taken from other locations. They found that the lunar soil was different depending on where it came from, which I found to be really shocking. I didn't realize that the lunar soil was going to have some significant differences in it depending on where you get it from. So they call the lunar soil mature if it was exposed to solar wind. This mature soil did not grow plants as well. The other two locations had better soil for growing, seemingly because they were not as exposed to solar wind. Now, this is an important finding because when astronauts do one day grow plants on the moon, what are they going to do? They're going to use lunar soil that has already been proven to grow healthier plants, which is probably soil that hasn't been exposed to the solar winds.
Or they'll grow them hydroponically.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Or maybe a half dozen other ways, Steve, right? You know, there's lots of other things that could come into play here. The research results, of course, solicited even more questions, right? Because when you successfully conduct a study, then you should end up with more questions that need to be answered after you do it. So the researchers want to know if there's anything in the lunar soil that's causing the stress to the plants, you know, or maybe there are things missing from the soil, which we already know that there are, but what are those things and how much of an effect are those missing things having on the plants? We already know soil is very different on the moon compared to Earth. You know, also maybe different plants would fare better in lunar soil than others. They may need to cultivate plants so they have certain properties that would handle the moon terrain better. Or we genetically engineer plants to grow on the moon, which was the very first thing I thought about, you know, when I read the study and they said that they were not having the plants grow as much as they like to. There's no doubt that plants are going to play an astonishingly critical role in our ability to have people live on the moon and eventually to Mars. Now, we recently talked about this, guys. Remember how plants can be engineered to produce certain chemicals, which means that they can become, you know, they could be drug factories if we want them to. Plants also can create oxygen. They can remove CO2 from the environment. They can also be eaten. You know, these are very useful things.
I really like how you say that word.
Not on the moon, Bob.
Eaten.
Eaten.
How do you say it?
Eaten.
Oh, no, I don't pronounce T's.
Love it.
Yeah, that's for suckers.
Too much
that's
work, right, man.
That's my that's Connecticut right, accent so at play.
Swallow that tea, man.
Yeah. So, and they're delicious. As you know, it costs a lot of money to bring anything into space. Bob loves to say this every time something comes up. It costs so much money. So this is – it's really expensive to get things into low Earth orbit. It's even more expensive to get things to the moon. I said that like William Shatner a little bit. It's even more expensive. this is why research is being done to find out what we can use that's already on the moon, right? We want to go there and use whatever we can that's there to help us.
Oh, yeah.
So NASA is exploring the moon's south pole, hoping to find water, and that would be freaking amazing if they really could squeeze water out of the regolith somehow. If they do this, it can save an incredible amount of money that it would have cost to bring water to the moon. Also, the moon is the first step in a much larger endeavor to have people living in space on the moon and on Mars pretty much permanently. You know, once we pass a certain point, there's always going to be people out there that are living in these different places. If we can successfully harvest resources from the moon, like water, oxygen, food, and the big one, fuel, this will make all of our efforts a lot easier. And my last thought here is research like this is essential as we move into the time when people will be living on the moon and Mars, and someday plants are going to serve as a huge food source for those people that live off planet. Steve said in his blog, which I liked, that it's not just all of these mechanical things that we would be doing and, you know, these utilitarian things, but being around plants also is good for your mind, right?
It's, yeah, it is.
It gives you peace of mind.
But you know what's interesting is that studies show that the plants don't have to be real.
Yeah. Oh. It's just a lot. Of course, it's the aesthetic that is important.
Yeah. I mean, that's
hardwired in there.
Do they even have to be plants then? Do they be pictures of plants?
Well, how about VR, Ev? You know what I mean?
Just put on your goggles.
That would probably help. Yeah.
You're in the forest.
But just in case anybody out there is going, why are they spending all this money, blah, 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 let me give you another motivator here. Now, a lot of NASA accomplishments and technology get passed on to the private sector and benefit people, right? Duct tape, you know what I mean? You know, what would you do without it? I don't know. But the thing here is, if they figure out better ways to grow food or to help with crop density and all of the things that they'll learn, all of this can apply to the Earth. And let's face it, you know, our population is exploding. It's a good thing for us to spend money and time into figuring out better ways to grow agriculture, essentially, right?
Yeah, yeah, right. Would this apply to extreme environments on Earth? We don't know. That's why it's research. But, and again, you know, I'm serious that I think, you know, hydroponics are probably going to be the primary way that we grow plants off Earth. But knowing that, you know, having as an option growing in Martian soil or lunar soil is interesting. And there may be plants or applications for which that's necessary. Hydroponics aren't good for everything. It's hard to grow corn hydroponically, you know.
Steve, you know, one thing they didn't mention, of course, they couldn't do this, but like low gravity could have a major effect. I was also thinking, you know, there might be at some point in the future, people might be walking around soil on the moon that's in some type of enclosure that begins to look a lot more like Earth soil.
Yeah, of course. Like once you grow plants in it over and over again, you know, that soil gets enriched by the organic matter in the plants themselves, et cetera. And, or there may be some way to treat the soil, you know, the regolith, to make it into more amenable soil for plants. They were just using straight, I was surprised. They just used straight lunar soil, like just straight lunar regolith.
Well, they had to see, I mean, what you're working with.
Yeah, yeah.
In a raw,
it was a proof of principle. Obviously, they put water and nutrients in it, right? They had to
spur it on to grow.
Yeah, obviously they needed that, but it was really more about. They weren't expecting the regolith to feed the plants. It was because
it's not a source of nitrogen.
But they just wanted to make sure it wasn't going to kill the plants or keep them from germinating in the first place. They were excited just that they germinated because they didn't know that was going to even happen. You know, definitely interesting. Where exactly it will lead is too early to say. But it was encouraging, and I like, you know, we've been keeping track of NASA's research. You know, they're doing a lot of research meant specifically to support having a permanent presence on the moon and eventually on Mars.
And Jay, real quick, you mentioned water on the moon. I just saw earlier today about this theory that there may be even more, you know, frozen, you know, ice water on the moon than we thought, released from volcanic eruptions a really long time ago when the Maria were created. They think, you know, 5 to 10 meters below the surface, there could be like thick sheets of ice, thicker than we would think. So that
would be amazing.
Yeah, there's so many. I think there's going to be a lot of water there because there's so many different ways we think it's already there. And it's been detected. It's just a matter of how much.
And water may be the biggest single resource to have locally
oxygen.
On the moon. Yeah, because hydrogen, oxygen, you get not
drink,
only water,
breathe, and
we
fuel.
Need water. You can get to grow your food. You can make fuel. You can make oxygen. You could make manufacture drugs and other things like that if you grow
Huge.
A plant. So,
it's
yeah, water.
Magic.
Water is it. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bob. This has been going around. Even on John Oliver, he made mention of this. We got a good picture of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way.
Yes.
Woohoo, finally.
Our very own black hole, as Steve said, the center of the Milky Way, called Sagittarius A star, now has a face, and we need to talk about it. And we've known something as weird as at the center of the Milky Way, 26,000 light years away, for a long time. The first hint had to be, I would think, the blasts of radio waves that were detected from a tiny source. Like, what's going on? Where's that coming from? And how could such a tiny source produce that? And then 40 years ago, astronomers were mapping the actual motion of stars near the galactic center, some of them moving at one-third the speed of light around an unseen object. Oh, what could it be?
Yeah.
So, yeah, little doubt, really, that there was a black hole with a mass of about 4 million suns. Sagittarius A star is about 26 million kilometers or 16 million miles in diameter. So it's just an amazing thing. But you may remember 3 years ago, the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration, the researchers there using a global network of 8 radio dishes, they revealed the very first picture of a supermassive black hole. Now, this was 50 million light years away in the M87 galaxy. It's an astonishing 6.5 billion solar masses. A gargantuan. Now, the system that they used, what it does actually is determine how much light is bent due to gravity. And that visual bending is apparently the official confirmation that a black hole exists there. Like, you need that official. You got to see it. You got to see that bending because, you know, if a compact source of gravity throwing stars around at one-third the speed of light is not enough for confirmation, I guess. You got to like see the light bend, which is because we always saw that as weird. Like, wait, it's throwing stars around at one-third the speed of light, based on this tiny volume of space? Well, of course. That should be confirmation enough. That's my point. All right, so to continue. So May 12th, this past May 12th, 2022, the same cool team of astronomers unveiled the severe bending of Moore light. It's the second image of a black hole. Our wonderful, if relatively small, supermassive black hole at only seemingly paltry 4 million solar masses, Sagittarius A star. So now, Google, if you Google the image right now, and if you can, do it. Google the image right now. What you'll see is a dark central area that has a glowing ring of light around it. And also three almost equidistant bead-like areas glowing even more intensely. The ring itself, that donut ring of glowing light, that's the glowing gas that's in orbit. The beads are gas as well, but they're just hotter and glowing more brightly. And they actually may drop into the black hole at some point. Also, by the way, some of that glow that you're seeing is coming from behind the black hole, which of course we can see because of our friend gravitational lensing. In case you didn't know, it's not a clear shot from here to the center of the Milky Way. You just can't look with anything and say, there it is, not invisible light. It's very dusty. And so don't even think about looking for details in visible light. It's absorbed to an amazingly huge extent, like 1 in 10 billion photons of visible light can actually get out. Radio waves are the radiation of choice here because it's longer wavelengths and it penetrates much better because of that. And in fact, the light ring that you may be seeing on your monitor right now, that you're seeing in visible light, was constructed from radio waves. Now, the creation of the image itself is an interesting story. So we're talking about the EHT, the Event Horizon Telescope, the 8 radio telescopes that are across the globe. Apparently, the observations filled up so many hard drives that these were nightly observations. They filled up so many hard drives that they had to be shipped to the final destination for processing instead of just uploading, because like it would break the internet or something. It was just way too much data to upload. And who knows the old school term for that?
What, breaking the internet?
No, I mean physically bringing the data yourself in hand, essentially.
Oh, sneakernet.
Sneakernet, yes, good, Steve.
Oh, no.
Sneakernet, yep, that is the term.
That's a term.
Well, it was. Nobody really says it much.
It's like snail mail, right? It's the same.
Exactly, okay. Same idea. Okay, so still, though, even with this data, putting the data together is not like your camera putting together an image of a picture that it takes. Very, very different because there's tons of uncertainty going on here. I mean, this thing is far away. It's very, very hard to see. There's lots of problems with, getting a full picture here. And this is true more so for Sagittarius A star than M87, which means that you could take all that data and create an image of the black hole that is absolutely justified based on the observation and the math and physics. Like, yes, this image makes sense. The problem is that you could also literally create tens of thousands of other images, each a little bit different, but equally justified based on the observations and the math and the physics. The differences, though, boil down to what? Educated guesses made because of incomplete data. The data is not complete. So the image you can't come up with, this is exactly the image of what we're looking at because of all that incompleteness. So the solution has been described in various ways. How did they get around this? Some people described it as combining all those pictures into one most accurate image, essentially taking tens of thousands of images, putting them all together and forming the final image out of that. That's one way to look at it. The American Physical Society described the process as narrowing down those guesses to recover the most likely underlying structure of Sagittarius A star. That's how they put it. Princeton black hole theorist Alex Lupsaska had my favorite description of the process of creating this final image. He described it as a probability distribution over many possible images compatible with the data. I really like that one as well. So, another quote from him was, "This breakthrough pushes the boundaries of our present technology and opens the door to future observations with even more exquisite precision, both from the ground and eventually from space," which would be cool. So there you have it, the image of our very own massive, supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way, Sagittarius A star. Congratulations to the astronomers who put in a ton of work. This image was much more difficult than M87 for various reasons. One being is that it's so small that the gas is orbiting so fast that when you have one observing session of our black hole, the gas like pretty much did an entire orbit. So basically you're taking these blurry pictures. So yes, their algorithms had to be fine-tuned over many years to try to get it so that they can, you know, infer what this object looks like. So I'll definitely go online, check it out. It's beautiful, and it's amazing to think that we're essentially taking a direct image of a black hole.
Yeah, totally cool.
Yeah, love it.
All right, Evan, tell us about this acupuncture article in Time.
Yeah, Time Magazine. I think we're all familiar with Time Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Hard copy? Is that?
Yeah, right.
Is it still alive?
Way back when. Apparently it is. You know, they still have Time Person of the Year, and, you know, people pay attention to that. They have a health and medicine section of Time Magazine. And here's a headline from the most recent one. Why Acupuncture is Going Mainstream in Medicine. Written by columnist Elizabeth Millard. She begins her article explaining the reasons why acupuncture remains prevalent among the choices of treatment for people's wellness. She says a blend of anecdotal studies, research-backed results, and growing level of openness from the medical community are the reasons why. And then she cites a 2021 World Health Organization report, which claims that acupuncture is the most widely used traditional medicine practice globally, and it's gaining traction in the United States. Maybe you should say right off the bat for clarity and the nature of the WHO when it comes to unscientific medical guidance. This is an organization that recently endorsed acupuncture and powdered rhino horns as COVID-19 therapies.
Ugh.
What the hell?
So kind of good to keep those little facts in the back of your mind when you talk about, listen,
the World Health Organization is a mixed bag, right? It's obviously critical. It's very important. It does great work, but it's also a political organization.
Oh, very.
And their huge blind spot is in a traditional medicine. Like when they
DCM.
Think, it's not just traditional Chinese medicine, but just any local medicine. Like we want to respect what every culture thinks their medicine is, whether it's science-based or real or not, you know. Sucking up to acupuncture all happened when the director of the WHO was Chinese and was like very much in favor of doing that against the evidence, you know, basically.
So good to keep in mind when thinking about the World Health Organization. You know, like you said, it's a mixed bag. And the Time article also references a Sage Journals report, which describes the growth of acceptance by patients and doctors in the United States. And it does so in a general sense. It's part of the report's introduction, which I read. So it didn't really provide hard data saying, here's our source, here are the numbers, here's how much prevalence it has today. I did some research on my own data for that. And what was often brought up was this. The article that appeared at PubMed said that it showed in 2002 there were 8 million people who participated in acupuncture, who sought out acupuncture. 2007, 14 million. Now, the Sage Journals report also makes an interesting point. It credits one of the main reasons people lately have been turning to non-pharmacological treatments is due to the overprescription of opioids, all the abuse and injury and death that has been reported in recent years about it. And they're saying that that's a key component as to sort of the recent increase in people's interest in obtaining acupuncture treatments.
And believe me, the acupuncturists and the alternative medicine gurus were all over that. They were promoting it as an alternative. That's why.
Oh, sure. Another reason why. 2020, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services began covering acupuncture for chronic low back pain, which covers, I'm sure, a lot of the cases in which people seek out that particular treatment. And when you have basically government-paid-for health care for our Medicaid and Medicare systems cover all of the senior citizens in our country, among other people, I mean, that can really only further increase the demand. And I also looked up how much money acupuncturists are making. They expect that in 2022, by the end of 2022, they'll see almost a 7% increase in their revenue compared to the prior year, 2021. So all these are indications that acupuncture is definitely on the rise, especially in the United States. Now, the Time article also continues, and she writes, although scientists don't yet understand all the nuances of how it works, research indicates it can have a significant effect on certain conditions, and it shows promise for others. I find that to be problematic for a lot of reasons. I mean, do we need to explain what acupuncture is?
Yeah, I mean, let me give the bullet. I mean, basically, it is sticking acupuncture needles, which are needles, into alleged acupuncture points, which don't exist, in order to modify the flow of the life force, which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Acupuncture is pre-scientific, superstition-based, you know, healthcare. That's what it is. And that's not even what it was. It's not ancient. That's not even what it was prior to about 100 years ago, when it was completely retconned into the modern version of traditional Chinese medicine. You know, if you go back even into the 19th century, acupuncture was like using these giant needles and sticking them into organs. I mean, it was like brutal, barbaric, you know, therapy. It really was. It was the East's version of bloodletting.
Yikes.
But it was sort of, you know, anyway, it was sort of updated and given a nice, more friendly, modern kind of patina to it. But it's 100% nonsense, you know?
Mm-hmm. But the article says, Steve, though, that the research indicates it can have a significant effect on certain conditions.
It's not true. It's simply not true. And This is where you have to get into the details, and you need to do like a science-based medicine evaluation of the relevant literature.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is that acupuncture has not been demonstrated to be effective for anything, you know, meaning that you have a consistent effect that replicates, that is clinically significant, that doesn't go away when you do better and better blinding, et cetera. It hasn't risen above the bar for a single indication. It really hasn't. It's just that there's just a lot of low-grade crappy studies. And every single time I see this, another study that says, oh, acupuncture works for X, the study is crap. It's utter crap. And they basically stopped doing the really good studies because they were showing that it doesn't work. That's always, again, you always have to look at the arc of the literature, the arc of the research. Where is it going? When you get to the best studies and they show that it doesn't work, and then the proponents back off to less rigorous studies, which show whatever they want to show, that's what tells you the story, right? That's what tells you you're dealing with something that doesn't work. Plus, I just have to point out that acupuncturists can't even agree where the acupuncture points are and what they do. It's random. It's astrology. It's literal astrology. That's literally its origins.
The only measurable positive benefits for some people from acupuncture are due to nonspecific effects. It's like...
It's the interaction with the acupuncturist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the interaction. It's like subjective measures like pain reduction, mood, like the types of things where an individual might feel pain reduction simply because the hands were laid on them, simply because they had a relaxing hour, simply because somebody touched them.
Yeah, it's all placebo effects.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's just an invasive, elaborate placebo. That's all it is.
And expensive. And one expensive. That, annoyingly, our healthcare dollars often cover. Like, more and more, we're seeing that insurance companies reimburse acupuncture.
Yep, more now than ever. That's right.
There's a political pressure. And because of gullible articles like this. This is sort of a self-reinforcing, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy kind of article. You notice that, like, you're saying, oh, it's more popular, people are more open to it, there's anecdotal evidence, and then just completely glosses over the utterly unimpressive scientific evidence, right? Like, rather than, and there's not a hint of skepticism, like, and there's entire, you know, leagues of professionals who think it's crap. You know, how about that?
Yeah,
and this
that?
Article could have been written 30 years ago is the other thing. You know, it's like, yeah, we've been hearing this tune for decades. It's still on the fringe scientifically. It's just that the more, you know, people beat the drum for it politically, the more it gets used. But that's it. It's not, there's no scientific revolution here. This is completely a triumph of marketing over science. That's what's happening here, 100%.
What this article also does is it is taking references and it's citing studies. For example, They linked to the BMJ article from February 2022. They said it analyzed more than 2,000 scientific reviews of acupuncture therapies. And they write, the science is strongest behind acupuncture's efficacy for post-stroke aphasia, neck, shoulder, and muscle pain, fibromyalgia pain, lactation issues after delivery, lower back pain, vascular dementia symptoms, and allergy symptoms.
Mm-hmm. What?
Are they is that what that BMJ analysis is truly saying?
Yeah, but listen, it's not that it's been established for any of them, just that if you look at a 2,000 different possible uses, those are the ones that are at the far side of the bell curve, right? It's mm-hmm. like you're going to get a random distribution, and these are the ones that randomly were trending in a positive direction. If you did those 2,000 studies all over again, it would be a different bunch of random things that
does that tell you?
That were at the right end. And also, what do those things have to do with each other? Nothing. So what's the mechanism that underlies post-stroke aphasia and post-surgical nausea? There's no commonality of mechanism there. You have right. to believe in magic. You have to believe in magic. It's just ridiculous.
So that's the danger with articles like this. They'll mm-hmm. cite things that sound impressive.
By a non-specialist who has no idea what they're talking about.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, but it's becoming more prevalent. And it's, for all the effort that, organizations like ourselves, Science-Based Medicine and others are doing out there who are providing the correct information on this, we're fighting an uphill battle.
Yeah, totally.
We just are.
All right, thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Anybody have any guesses?
Is it a Boyd?
It's not. A whale? It's not a bird.
Creative flatulence.
No.
Perry's bottle of water.
Yes, exactly. That's what it sounded like. So Danilo Escobar wrote in and said, hello, Jay. My two boys guessed this week. Kai, who's age 4, guessed it was robot birds shooting lasers.
Aw.
And then he made the pew, pew, pew sound. His brother, Gael, age 6, guessed people playing laser tag, but one of the laser guns is almost out of batteries. I think that those were two very cute guesses. I appreciate them guessing at Who's That Noisy. Guys, you're not correct, but you made very good guesses. You should be proud of yourselves. Amy Brodigan wrote in and said, hi, everyone. But yes, I know it's Jay that handles Who's That Noisy. The Who's That Noisy for today sounds a lot like the genetically hybridized singing mice from episode 284.
Hybrid.
It's a hybrid. That is not correct, although, yes, they do sound like little mice a little bit. I can hear that in there. Kurt Welling wrote in and said purple martens. And when I first read it, I thought he said purple Martians, and I'm like, what? Anyway, he said the only wild songbirds completely dependent on human-provided housing. I have never heard of purple martens, but apparently they exist.
I have a martin house. I put it up like 3 years in a row, and I never got any martens, and I kind of lost track of it somewhere in my basement.
Yeah, maybe they don't live around here. I don't know.
They're supposed to find it. I think what happened was is I missed the very narrow window like every year, like when you're supposed to put it up. I just, by the time I thought about it, because it's like early in the spring, and like if you miss the window, like it's too late, they found their house.
Oh, it's okay. Steve Martin's.
Yeah. Another listener named Lenka Kuglerova wrote in and said, she's from Sweden, and she said, hi, Jay, I wonder if this week's Who's That Noisy is an ocarina. Do you guys know what that is?
Yeah, it's that song from the 90s.
You guys ever play Zelda?
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Yeah, and one of them, he played an ocarina. So it's a little like clay, kind of hamburger kind of shaped flute type thing that has holes on it, that has a really nice soft kind of round sound to it. But it is not an ocarina, but that is a great guess. I think I actually still own one of those. Now we have not only one winner, we have two winners from last week. Aren't you curious? Like, why would we have two winners? I'm going to explain this to you.
Same second.
They sent in the answer at 4:52 p.m. on the same day at the same exact time. So I'm like, yep, that qualifies. This is the first time. So we the winners are Shane Hillier and Jasmine Worth. And basically, they wrote pretty much the same thing. They said, this is a bird-shaped whistle. You fill it with water, and it play. You know, it plays that warbly kind
of
tune.
I had one of those.
Yep.
I have one. I have.
Yeah. Yeah,
each of my daughters has one of those.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yep, I actually have one in my house as well. It's also called a warbling whistle. Let me play it for you again. Keep in mind that what's happening here is there's a mouthpiece that you blow into, and then you're blowing down into like a bubble that has water in it, and that bubble of water is moving over the whistle part, and that's why it kind of feels like it's the sound is moving a little bit. But it does make a pretty good bird sound, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah.
So anyway, you know, I like this one because it did remind me of being a kid and my kids have it. And guess what? A lot of people guess this right. So apparently a lot of us have run into these things during our lifetime at one point or another. So thank you, Justin, for sending that in. I have a new noisy for you guys this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Jeff Chapin. And here it is. So we've been doing Who's That Noisy for a very long time. I actually can think of several things that make sounds like this. And that's why I think that, you know, what I've learned from doing Who's That Noisy and then also listening to Evan run it for years is that it is remarkable how many things can sound like other things, and context is very important. And that's what's interesting about this, because you don't get the context, you just get the sound. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, you got to email that to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. We got a couple of emails here. One, Bob, is a response to your piece from last week on AI and art. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this comes from Noah. And Noah writes that, currently, I work for an AI company that helps the largest companies create and deploy their machine learning solutions. It is a groundbreaking industry, which I think you know well enough and highlight on your show. One thing that I specifically appreciated was that you, unlike most other commenters, touched on the fact that there was a prevalent bias in these large models. This brings me to my main point, which is that there was a huge emphasis in the latest episode placed on the idea that DALL-E understands and knows things about the image and contexts within. He goes on to describe that some more and some criticizing. And his point, basic point, is that you have to be careful with language and know the algorithm doesn't quote unquote understand or quote unquote know anything. And so, you know, Bob, he basically was criticizing your science communication. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, definitely has a point there. What he was saying in some of the other details and quotes that he offered in the email was essentially that, you know, that language models that are used as training data for these various things, they use a combination of form and meaning. I mean, they don't use it, but language is often a combination of form and meaning. But DALL-E 2 uses only the form part. It's not really using the meaning that are attached to the words. It's just the form, really, of that. And with no meaning attached. And so therefore, when you use the term understanding, it's very fraught with problems, because when you use the word understanding, it's got a lot of baggage. It implies that the meaning component, and he's saying the meaning component's really not there. So that problematic to use the word understanding in any context, because they really don't understand the language or the words or the text in any meaningful way.
Well, no current AI understands anything. I assumed you were using those words as metaphors, and you were.
To a large extent, but his point was that it's actually risky and it's not worth it to even throw around that kind of terminology
with this
specific thing. And that's absolutely fair. My point was that I was very impressed with, especially the in-painting image aspect of it, where you could take a piece of it and wipe it away and say, now put this in there. And the way that it can replace parts with other parts based from the text that's input and without affecting the realism. So in some sense, I was trying to say that it has some understanding of the image and the components and how they relate to each other. Cause it seems to quite often create an image that still makes sense, even though you're changing it kind of willy nilly here and there. But his point is well taken that using the term understanding doesn't really apply in this context. And that it's just really kind of risky to even say that because people just take that and run with it. And believe me, I mean, I read a lot about artificial intelligence on Reddit and people are just running with stuff. It's like, so I absolutely get it. And I'll definitely be more careful about using the word understanding in this context in the future.
Yeah, of course, you know, AI understands nothing, but it acts as if it does, right? It's mimicking understanding. It's
right,
the whole point of narrow AI. But it does highlight the fact that we need language, right? We need a language so that we can communicate, like not in technical language, but in a colloquial language to the general public so that they can understand what's happening. And when you rely on these metaphors, it gets the job done, but it does create, it opens the door for misunderstanding. So what I would like to explore is, and maybe we should bring on somebody to talk about this at some point, is how do we talk about narrow AI in a way that's efficient, that conveys meaning, but that doesn't lend itself to misunderstanding or confusing narrow AI with general AI, like that something that might actually have human level understanding, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely need to do that. We should pull somebody in because there's you know, I don't know if you've noticed it as well, Steve, but there's a lot going on in AI. Yeah. It's really, you know, it's really ramping up, it seems. I mean, so many amazing tools are coming out, you know, not just GPT and DALL-E 2 now. There's lots of things that are coming out that are just amazing tools, you know, not just DALL-E 2, but, you know, GPT as well that we've talked about and other tools that are going to definitely be part of future discussions that I won't go into detail that are just really, you know, not only are they amazing tools, but there's also amazing opportunities for people to really go crazy with it in terms of like exaggerating possibilities and time frames and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, things are happening and you'll definitely be hearing more about it on the SGU, but more responsibly maybe.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. All right. Another quick email. This one comes from Chuan Hao and they write, I recently came across this Instagram post of a person just eating raw foods for over 100 days. Curious to how much raw food is humanly acceptable to consume. Cheers from Singapore, too. Oh, well, thank you. All right, so raw food obviously is uncooked food, and there's a, you know, raw food, you know, diet and craze, et cetera, you know, making all kinds of claims, most of which are utterly ridiculous. I've written about this at least once on Science-Based Medicine. There's probably a couple of other articles there as well. So there's no, like, you know, magical special benefits to eating a purely raw food diet. I mean, they make statements like, oh, you kill the food before you eat it. Yeah. What do you think happens when it hits your stomach? I mean, like there's some magical essence in the food that you're killing when you cook it. Cooking is actually a fantastic innovation. So the things that they say that at least sound scientific are like you're degrading the nutrients. Like, that's actually quite negligible for, you know, unless you boil the crap out of things before you eat it. But if you're just like normally cooking food, it's very modest, any like actual degradation of nutrients. What you're actually doing is making the food more digestible and allowing yourself to extract more nutrients from the food. When we started cooking, that's when humans dominated the world. When we ate, literally, that's when our remains are scattered about the world and went out of Africa when we started cooking our food. It was probably also necessary to support our growing brain, right? Our very, very hungry brain. Cooking is good for food. It helps you eat more things and extract more nutrients from more different things. But this is the other question, is eating just raw food dangerous for you? Not in and of itself. You could survive, you know, on eating only foods that are not cooked. The challenge is getting insufficient nutrients, you know?
Right. It's having a similar challenge you see when you go like super vegan. Anytime you restrict yourself.
Yeah. Any restrictive diet. Yeah. And we have to ask our patients this all the time. It's like a standard question. Do you have any kind of dietary restrictions?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because it highly correlates with nutritional deficiencies that we then have to check for and may need to treat. Mm-hmm. Usually not scurvy, but it's mainly the B vitamins that we
yeah, like B12. If somebody's vegan, they might not be. Yeah, that's common. Iron or whatever.
Iron, B2. Yeah, there's a lot of ones that we can see. Yeah, it's just very challenging if you don't know what you're doing. And of course, people say, you can. Yeah, of course you can. I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying that you have to be really knowledgeable and careful and really dedicated, and that there are plenty of people who can't pull it off and they end up being malnourished. They end up having, poor nutrition as a result. So there's no reason for it, and it is risky, so I don't recommend it. But you could theoretically live on a raw food diet. There's nothing directly harmful to you about it. It's just challenging again to get a good broad nutrition from it. Okay, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
Yeah,
it's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake-a-rooney, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I like this one. We have a good theme this week. The theme is, which is bigger?
Does that mean we get a 50-50 chance of getting this?
Well, of each one.
Each one's either right or wrong.
Gosh. What are the odds? I've got to calculate these odds now.
All right, here we go. Item number 1. The worldwide gaming industry grossed 9.4 times as much revenue in 2021 as the worldwide film industry. Item number 2. The largest adult tardigrades are larger than the smallest adult fleas. And item number 3. The largest known star in the universe is UY Scuti, with a radius larger than the average distance of Pluto from the sun. Kara, go first.
This is crapshoot time.
You could logic your way through these. You can.
Think I can reason my way, really?
Well, give it a try.
Okay. Gaming industry grossed 9.5 times as much revenue in 2021 as the film industry. And so when you say revenue, you're literally just talking about box office sales, selling the things. You're not talking about minus expenses. We think of the film industry as being like the big thing. I think this one might be a little confusing to me because when I think about like YouTube, for example, they've had to actually adjust their algorithm. So the only thing you don't see is gaming videos because it's like orders of magnitude more gaming videos than other things on YouTube. So I wouldn't be surprised if the industry, I don't really know how we define the industry, like what is that inclusive of, but I'm sure it's enormous. And the film industry is like, there's Bollywood and there's films that come out of countries, but the American film industry dominates, whereas the gaming industry is probably more spread out. Okay, the largest adult tardigrades are larger than the smallest adult fleas. So basically we know tardigrades are microscopic, but you can see them with light microscopy. Like I could just pull out the microscope that's in my closet right now and get some pond water and see tardigrades, no problem. You don't need like an electron microscope to see them. And fleas, we're used to the ones on our dogs that are visible to the naked eye. Naked eye there, Bob. Naked eye.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's probably really tiny fleas. Would they still be called fleas? Are they lice? I don't know. But I'm sure there's like microscopic fleas. Is that even a generic term? Or is that a real scientific term, flea?
It is a type of animal, right?
Okay, all right. And then the largest known star in the universe, UY Scuti? Scuti?
Yeah,
UY Scuti?
One of those.
Yeah. With a radius larger than the average. A radius, not even a diameter?
In other words, if it were in our solar system where the sun is, it would extend beyond Pluto.
Yeah, because the center of it would be where the sun is, and then that one side.
Its radius would be the orbit of Pluto, yeah.
And this is where this is going to screw me because I suck at like astronomical scales. I just cannot think in terms of numbers that big. And nothing surprises me when I hear, like, you could add or subtract multiple zeros to things. Like when Bob is telling his, and I'm like, I don't know. Sure. Seems right. So, I mean, this one seems impossible, but maybe that's why you put it in there. Gaming industry, they all seem like science. I'm going to say, I'm literally throwing a dart at a dartboard here. I think the gaming industry one is definitely science. I think the tardigrades are definitely science. I think the sun could be science. I'm going to say the tardigrades are the fiction. I don't know.
Okay, Jay.
The world gaming industry grossed 9.4 times as much revenue than the worldwide film industry. I think this is science. I think that, you know, people spend a lot more money on gaming than they do movies. If I use myself as an example, this is clearly what reality is. I'll go down to the third one. The largest known star in the universe that has a radius larger than the average distance of Pluto from the sun. So, you know, I agree with Kara. I mean, you know, I would say even something like, that's it? You know, I would think that the largest known star could even be bigger than that. And, you know, you ever see those things where they show you the star, then they show you the next size one?
Yeah,
the next
I love
size
that.
One,
I love that.
This keeps on
shit.
Going and going. Uh-huh. So, I mean, a part of me thinks that there would be stars that are, you know, that's a pretty big size. That's really big. Pluto is very far away from the sun. So I would tend to think that this one would be science over the tardigrade one because from my understanding, fleas are visible and tardigrades basically are not to the naked human eye. Tardigrades are microscopic animals and fleas are not microscopic. So, I mean, I just don't see the variation between the adults and the smallest version that these things would come out in when they're born. I just don't think that there would be that much crossover. I think they're in two different size categories. So I think number two, the tardigrades ones, is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
The tardigrades one, I have no idea. I get they're microscopic. Smallest adult fleas. I think I know what a flea size is, but I have no sense for really this comparison. Whereas the other two, I kind of have a sense for the gaming industry one. 9.4 times as much revenue as the worldwide film industry, which seems incredible, and it is incredible, the gaming industry is not to be underestimated, and that would be underestimating that if I were to choose that as fiction. So that one, I think, is science. This last one about the star, UY Scuti, radius larger than the distance of Pluto from the sun. As Jay said, Pluto's far. I mean, it is very far. I have this vision in my mind of Jupiter being sort of the halfway point between the sun and Pluto, but it's not even that. Like, Pluto's way further out than Jupiter is not even the halfway point. So you're talking about something that, I don't know, that seems to defy what little I know about the size of stars. And even with those graphics, Jay, that you mentioned and stuff, gee whiz, I don't see it being that big. Oh my gosh. The star has to be the fiction. How could it be?
Okay, Bob.
All right. The gaming industry, yeah, it's gargantuan. It makes perfect sense. It's so big. Tardigrades, yeah, that one doesn't seem quite right, especially when you think of the Ant-Man. Remember when the older guy was shrinking down and he's shrinking. Oh, there's a tardigrade. It's like, they're small. And I didn't think a adult fleas could potentially be there. I guess it's got to be because, I mean, Scooty's, you know, yeah, Pluto's too big. That's way too far. You know, I'm thinking more Jupiter, Saturn type of distance, not Pluto. That's so fiction.
Wow, we're split.
All right, you guys are split. So we'll go back to number one. The worldwide gaming industry grossed 9.4 times as much revenue in 2021 as the worldwide film industry. You guys all comfortably think that this one is science. And this one is science. All right, you're all safe so far.
Big money.
So remember, 2021, pandemic. People were at home playing video games, not so much going out to movies. But even on normal years in the last decade, the gaming industry is four times the film industry, even at baseline. It's massive. It is absolutely massive. And, like, you know, if you've played one of the high-end games, the budgets are similar. Right. Like, you get named actors voicing characters, and the production value is absolutely off the hook. So, yeah, not a surprise to anybody familiar with the gaming industry. But, yeah, the idea – but it's, I like this because, like, you're comparing two things that you know. Like, you know they're both big, and it's kind of interesting to try to figure out which one is bigger. I guess we'll take these in order. The largest adult tardigrades are larger than the smallest adult fleas. Jay and Kara, you think this is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. Now, this one's interesting because fleas are generally considered to be barely macroscopic, right? Barely naked eye visible. And tardigrades are barely microscopic. Yeah. They're barely not visible.
I'm sure one of them crosses over the threshold.
So fleas, the smallest adult male fleas are smaller than adult female fleas. The smallest adult male flea is about 1 millimeter long. 1 millimeter, right? That's how small they get. Wow. Tardigrades, remember tardigrade is, it's not a species, right? It's not one thing. It's a family. It's pretty high up there. Whatever.
Yeah, you're right. It's not even a genus. I think it is higher than that.
It's definitely higher than a genus. Phylum.
Yeah. Phylum. It's a phylum?
Phylum tardigrada.
A phylum.
Jesus.
Holy shit.
That's King Philip. That's only the second thing. After that, the animal kingdom.
Hell.
Huh. That's
phylum
cool.
Phylum tardigrada. Yeah, so
I know I'm wrong.
Yeah, right.
So don't forget the D, Kara, the domain. They shuffled, you know.
Right. There's a decay. Yeah. This is, I'm going back to my elementary school education in the 80s. Right,
so
yeah.
Tardigrades can range from 0.05 millimeters at the low end, the small end, to 1.2 millimeters. So they do overlap in the middle, which is interesting. The largest tardigrades are bigger than the smallest fleas, but they're right. That 1 millimeter is right at the cusp of macroscopic to microscopic. And so that's interesting. It gives you this sort of this, it's that boundary thing, right, Jay? Remember we talked about that. It's like they overlap, but you think of fleas as macroscopic and you think of tardigrades as microscopic. But some tardigrades are, you can see with the naked eye.
Which means?
Interesting. Which means that
shut up.
The largest known star in the universe is UY Scuti, with a radius larger than the average distance of Pluto from the sun, is the fiction. Now, what's fiction about that, Bob?
It doesn't have a radius as large as Pluto. It's smaller.
Yeah. What would you guess?
Well, I guess like Jupiter-Saturn type of distance, not
yeah, you're closer.
All the way.
So UY Scuti is recognized as the largest star in the universe, but there's an asterisk next to that because there's
an asterisk or an asterisk?
I said asterisk.
It's an orbit.
Next to that because there's uncertainty in the size and there's estimates. So the uncertainty overlaps with other stars, but if you take the average estimated size of the star, it is the largest average estimated size of a star, whatever. But it's possible that there's like one or two other stars that if Scuti is actually at the low, very, very low end of its uncertainty range, and these other stars are at the high end of their range, you know, they could actually overtake it. But anyway, but the average estimated size is 1,708 solar radii, right? Wow. So 1,708 times the size of our sun, or 15.9 AU, astronomical units, one AU being the average distance of the Earth to the sun. So 15.9 AU. So Evan, you said, yeah, Jupiter's far out there, but it's actually not that far. It's 5.2 AU on average. 5.2.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Earth is 1, Mars is 1.5, Jupiter is 5.2. Saturn is 9.5, Uranus is 19.2. So this star
crazy
would be between Saturn and Uranus, but Pluto is 39.5.
Yeah.
It's like almost three times.
Crazy out there.
The distance. So yeah, Pluto's way, way too far out there. So, right.
I gotta go with my gut more.
But you're Kara, you did, you know, pretty reasonably, you know, think your way through these items. It was just, you know, came down to a couple, you know, of tricky things, but they were tricky by design. You know, I tried to make these thought processes difficult, but you had a chance.
That's just so immense. Oh my
God. 15.9 AU. They're red
giants. How long does it live? A century? I mean, it must burn through its fuel so fast.
No, Bob, these are red giants. These just happen to be at the end of their life.
That's true.
Yeah, these are not blue stars that big. These are red giants.
Okay.
When the stars, you know, they expand at the end of their lifespan. They become massive.
Yeah, so it's kind of like it's like a mask.
And because it's very would be very thin, you know.
Wafer thin.
That was a fun one. I like that.
Yeah.
Hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, our sun itself, when it's red giant phase, it'll
go beyond far. Mars.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be pretty damn big, but tenuous.
Right, and those astronomy stats were courtesy Fraser Cain at Universe Today. So I'll give him a tip of the hat.
Hi, Fraser.
Fraser.
His were the articles that came up when I was looking up the details. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The quote this week comes recommended from Catherine, who's a listener from North Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you, Catherine. She calls this one an inspiration quote from an article featuring the black hole image, which we talked about earlier. This image is a testament to what we can accomplish when, as a global research community, we bring our brightest minds together to make the seemingly impossible possible. Language, continents, and even the galaxy can't stand in the way of what humanity can accomplish when we come together for the greater good of all. And that was said by National Science Foundation Director Sethuraman Panchanathan. So nice little tip of the hat to the amazing science behind the Sag A picture.
It's always good to remind the public of how absolutely amazing science can be at its best.
Oh my God, right? Yes.
When people get together and just do amazing projects, it's just unbelievable the power of what we can do now. You know,
it's all because of the process of science. People are imperfect, make mistakes a lot. But when you got a good process like science, it just reinforces itself and it just produces the wonders of the world.
Absolutely. All right, guys, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, Steve.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.